Welcome back to The Short Coat. I'm Dave Etler. Clubfoot is a congenital deformity of the foot and affects between 150,000 and 200,000 babies each year worldwide. Extensive surgery was once the standard of care for clubfoot, improving the appearance of the foot but resulting in poor mobility and pain in midlife. Dr. Ignacio Ponseti, a University of Iowa physician, pioneered what has become known as the Ponseti method. It involves manipulation of the newborn's feet via casting and splinting and has replaced surgery as the gold standard. While the Ponseti method doesn't involve expensive surgeries or equipment, it does require detailed knowledge of both the anatomy of the foot and of the method itself. In the case of clubfoot, the key to a cure is the education of physicians. Easy enough in the U.S. and other developed countries, but 80% of cases occur in developing nations, and most babies are left untreated or receive substandard care. It's difficult for physicians there to get the information they need to perform the method correctly. To date, spreading the Ponseti method involved visits by physicians from the developed world to the developing world to teach and perform the method. But Carver College of Medicine student Asita Jayawardena's healthcare experience in South America led him to the notion that educating one leader on the topic would allow them to spread the method among his colleagues in a culturally appropriate manner. At his urging, the American Medical Student Association created the Ponseti Scholarship to help spread the technique. Recently, Asita sat down with Dr. Mansoon Ali Khan, an orthopedic surgeon from Karachi, Pakistan, and the Ponseti Scholarship's first beneficiary, to talk about Khan's experiences at the University of Iowa as he learns more about the Ponseti method.
Dr. Khan, would you like to tell us a little bit about what you do in Pakistan and where you're from?
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. I am an orthopedic surgeon working in the city of Karachi in Pakistan. I work at the Indus Hospital, which is a free-for-all institution in the sense that we provide quality care free of cost to any person who is willing to come through the system. My interest is mainly pediatric orthopedics, joint replacements, and arthroscopic surgery, but the interest in pediatric orthopedics is becoming quite dominant now, and especially the Ponseti method of treatment of children born with a clubfoot deformity. This technique was pioneered here in Iowa by Dr. Ponseti, and it has gradually, over the last 50 years, become the predominant and acknowledged best way of treating children with clubfoot deformity. This has become more accepted in the last 5-10 years, and we have been using this technique sort of on a self-taught basis for about 4 to 5 years now. But until you see the proper way of doing it, you see someone who's worked with Dr. Ponseti do it, there is a lot of errors which can creep in because it's a very exacting technique to correct a deformed foot just by sequential plaster casts. So I was invited to come here, and it's been a very enlightening, very useful, very hectic sort of 2 weeks in which I've gotten to see the people who have trained with Dr. Ponseti, who developed the technique with him, to actually do the procedure in outpatient clinics and to see how it's done, get an understanding, and hopefully we want to introduce this process there.
All right. So tell me a little bit about what your plan is after you go back to Pakistan, after having the experience of really being able to apprentice under the, you know, University of Iowa Orthopedics Department here.
Well, we have already started a project which we've called Pehla Kadam, which in our language, if you convert back to English, is the first step. And it really is the first step of introducing formally the Ponseti technique to my country, because a lot of people doing what they call is the Ponseti technique, but it is basically their perception of what the Ponseti technique is. And a lot of doctors, being great innovators, have introduced little corrections in the technique to suit themselves. But the more you deviate from the very exacting method of doing it for the sake of convenience, for the sake of ease of the person putting on the plasters, the more errors you introduce and the worse the results get. So we will be starting our first clinics towards the second half of October, which will be the Pehla Kadam Clubfoot Clinic. And we will be doing casting of children who are newborn till the age of 6 months, initially starting to work with the youngest kids because you get the best results. This technique is applicable to kids up to 12, 15 years of age, according to data which we see now published worldwide. But we'll be starting with the youngest, most flexible feet to get ourselves into practice, get the best result before we move on to the more challenging cases. Long-term plan would be to take it from our institution to citywide, to province-wide, and then nationwide. Convert it into a national program, basically.
So who's helping you with creating that plan? Where are you getting the funding from, et cetera?
Well, the start was very interesting because the institution where I work is about 5 years old now. And about 2.5 years ago, a software person from San Francisco, who's of Pakistani origin, he came and visited us in Karachi, saw the hospital and said that his daughter had been born with a club foot and had been corrected by the Ponseti method without requiring any surgery. And he was wanting to know why we are not using this technique as much as it's used here in the U.S. My reply was that we do use it, but we're not experts in it. So he wanted us to start a program about treating kids in this manner. The hospital was very new at that time, and I said, we're not ready. So this was followed by about a year and a half of nonstop emails, phone calls, asking me when the institution would be ready. So I said sort of in the early part of this year that now we're in a position to actually start working on this. And we drew up a proposal and sent it to Mr. Amir, who's our friend also. He then emailed us that he would like Ponseti International Association, which is the group which is sort of in the memory of Dr. Ponseti himself here at Iowa University, which is the main group which is looking forward to dissemination of this technique worldwide. He wanted to email our proposal here, and I said, fine, let them have a look at it because they're the experts. It was followed by a conference call and a lot of discussions which sort of led up to my being asked to visit Iowa University, sponsored by the American Medical Student Association, to learn the technique, basically train the trainer. And I will go back, I'll be doing clinic, but I'll hopefully be training more trainers. And I'm being given a lot of resources in order to do that. Models to, you know, practice casting on, articulated foot models to explain the technique, because we don't have any of these things in my country. And as we train more and more trainers, hopefully we will be in a position maybe in 6 months to take it beyond our institution. The first 6 months are being sponsored by the Amir Haider Charitable Foundation based in San Francisco. We do not have any funding beyond 6 months, but we are looking at a number of sources nationally as well as internationally who will be willing to partner us in taking this beyond our institution.
That's really amazing. So tell me a little bit about some of the other, I know you've been involved with some other departments since in your 2 weeks here at Iowa in terms of giving you resources when you go back to Pakistan. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what else you've been learning and been involved with while you've been here?
Well, it's been a very hectic 2 weeks, very interesting 2 weeks. I've been observing in the operating room with Dr. Jose Marquende, Dr. Fred Dietz. Not only do I see how they're doing surgery, but I'm trying to observe, you know, how the scrub nurse is setting out the operating room, how the anesthetist is working. So anything I can see which I can take back to improve our quality of care. A lot of what I'm seeing is available on the internet, but reading something and seeing how it's actually done, it's a huge difference. So I'm picking up lots of useful points. We met with Tom Cook, who's head of public health, had a very good session with him yesterday regarding the use of Illuminate teleconferencing and how it's accessible to countries where the internet is working at a very low bandwidth, low speed. I invited him to be a speaker at one of our symposia next year. Also learned a lot about just how an orthopedic department operates in an institution of this size. I have given a talk to the medical students here, third-year medical students who basically sponsored this fellowship. I had a talk yesterday to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council, which is more on status of healthcare in my country rather than clubfoot, but clubfoot was also the end part of the talk. Have some more meetings with lots of useful people here. One very useful thing which I found here is the Wider Net project, in which they have produced something which they call the e-granary, which is a 2 terabyte hard disk which contains an entire library of information. And in countries like ours, sometimes internet is not accessible. And because of a very conservative-minded pattern of a lot of the people in my country, they don't allow children access to the internet, worried as to what subversive or other kind of literature the children may find. So I'll be picking up one of these hard drives today to take it back to my country. It'll be set up at our institution as an intranet, because we have a very large school of nursing and they don't have access to the internet at the school of nursing for this very reason. And there's a lot of stuff for the student nurses to look at, a lot of stuff for our residents to look at. And hopefully we will show it to other groups in my country who are into education, and we'll encourage them to get involved with this as well. Because knowledge is the way countries will develop. Not weapons, not guns, just knowledge.
So kind of along that note, a lot of the Western perception of Pakistan, at least especially by our media, is that it's a country of, you know, terrorism. It's very dangerous. Our State Department has warnings for, you know, for people who are interested in going there, etc. Is that Western perception true? Is that kind of what you see living there as a physician, or what's the real story?
Well, The stories in the media, obviously, they are based on fact to a great extent, but the perception which is springing from those stories may be a little exaggerated. Not everybody is shooting at everybody in my country, but there are enough crazy people with weapons running around who don't seem to be in anyone's control doing that. We do seem to face it daily because with my daily drive to work, many times in the year I find that the road may be blocked because of some sort of a disturbance going on or tires burning on the road or even firing in the air. Some colleagues of mine have had, you know, bullets hit their cars while they were traveling, and this has happened more times than we would like. Fortunately, no one's been hurt so far, but we never know. But the thing is, most people in most countries in the world just want to have a daily day's work and earn a daily sort of day's wage. Day-to-day living is quite difficult in third world countries, and most people don't have time to, you know, get into bomb blasts and explosions, but somehow we can't seem to control it as much as we would want to.
So tell us a little bit more about Pakistan for those of us who don't know that much about it, in terms of how developed of a country it is and what the health system is like.
Well, Pakistan is 64 years old now, became independent in 1947 when the British withdrew from India. It is a country of about 180 million, the sixth most populous nation on the planet. My city, Karachi, is the 12th largest city in the world and may become within the top 10 if our growth rate keeps up. It has, unfortunately, the highest illiteracy rate among emerging economies, and 18% of our GDP is spent on defense, while 4% is spent on health. So, which is why we do have large public sector hospitals, some being like 1,900 bed or 2,000 bed in size, but the number of patients who are seen is very small compared to the size of the institution, because they work, say, from 9, 10 o'clock in the morning till about 1, 2 in the afternoon, and that's it. They're not like full day accessible to everybody unless you have an emergency. Pakistan is known worldwide for being a country with nuclear weapons, is reputed to have armed gangs roaming the streets all the time, but that's not always the case. And we have some very good people there. We have, you know, one person, Dr. Professor Abdul Salam, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics. We have Abdul Sattar Eidi, a very renowned social worker nationally and internationally, who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. We're quite active in sports. Our country has won the Cricket World Cup, the Hockey World Cup about 4 times, Squash British Open Championship 8 times, which is a world record. Last year, Ehsaan Ul Haq from Pakistan lost in the doubles final at the US Open at Flushing Meadows. Interesting thing was that his partner was from India. And even though we're supposed to be traditional enemies, once we decide not to fight, we can achieve quite a lot.
I have to just mention here that the Pakistani cricket team's next series is against the Sri Lankan cricket team. And so while we're friends right now, we're going to be rivals in a few weeks. So and then we'll be friends again.
but that's fine. Sports should not be about rivals. You know, someone has to win, someone has to lose. And cricket is a good game. I watch it when I get the chance. And the Sri Lankan team is among the best in the world. And I'm sure it'd be an interesting series to watch, because matches between India and Pakistan, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, India, Sri Lanka, these three countries, they're never boring. Mm-hmm. They're always interesting. You always get a result.
Yeah. So back to the topic at hand. We were, tell us, you could do a good job of describing kind of Pakistan's, you know, the state that it's in right now. But I've been really, I've learned quite a bit about the Indus Hospital, which is the hospital that you're working at right now. Tell us a little bit more about Indus, some of the projects that they're doing.
Well, the Indus Hospital has a very interesting beginning. When I was in medical school, I just joined my first year. Some of my senior college mates who were in fourth year or final year medical school were running something called the Patients Welfare Association, in which they would be providing free medications, free blood, which is appropriately screened, blood products, anti-tuberculosis therapy, lab services on a volunteer basis. These students had built up a blood bank, a drug bank, a mini laboratory, because the government hospital where we were training was totally inadequate for the number of patients it was receiving. So these seniors would sit down and they would say that one day we will have a hospital of our own where we would treat everybody free of cost. Because even in the public sector hospitals, the government will provide, say, for 100% of the treatment, they would provide 40% of the facilities. 60 to 80% sometimes the patient would have to pay from their own pocket, even in a free government hospital. So we could see most patients in a country where the, you know, 22% are earning less than a dollar a day, beyond the reach of most people. So all of these seniors, some went off and specialized in cardiac surgery. One became a pediatric urologist. One was an anesthetist. So after finishing the medical school, they went outside Pakistan. They did their specialization, some in UK, some in US, all came back. And about 5 years ago now, we took over a hospital which was sort of shut down, not running properly. We sort of stripped it down, converted it into a paperless, very state-of-the-art, very clean institution. It is paperless. It's the only hospital in the country which is totally paperless. All our patient medical records, labs, imaging, accounting records, even kitchen stuff coming and going is all paperless. Nothing is on paper. And the software was developed by our own IT people within the hospital. We did not buy an imported software because that goes anywhere from $2 to $4 million. Mm-hmm. So we're learning to do the maximum while spending the minimum. Mm-hmm. And the good thing about this institution is it is free for anybody who walks in, whether they're Muslim, they're a non-Muslim, they're affording, they're non-affording. So we have a Muslim patient on the next bed, next to a Christian patient, next to him will be a Hindu patient, next bed may be a Parsi patient. So we do not discriminate. We treat all people from every walk of life. We even get patients from Afghanistan. So there's even no restriction that the patient has to be a Pakistani national, because there's still a war going on in Afghanistan and we get wounded and people who are unable to get access to healthcare in Afghanistan drift down to the south of the country. And, you know, it's a very heterogeneous patient population we've got. Mm-hmm. And we are currently at 150 beds, which includes the beds which we count as the, you know, the coronary care unit, the intensive care unit, dialysis. But we are scaling up to take it up to about 700 beds over the next 5 years. And hopefully construction will start sometime this year. So we will try to maintain our good standards. We do a lot of work with international institutions like Johns Hopkins, with which we just completed what's called the Pneumonia Project. It's funded by the Gates Foundation. We have technical collaboration with MIT. We do a lot of work with the WHO because we run the tuberculosis control program for the southern half of the country, especially the MDR-TB, multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, mm-hmm. which is a real lethal situation in which no medicine will work on that patient. And these patients are highly contagious, and we have among the highest rates of drug-resistant TB in the world. But we have about over 200 patients now which we're treating, because the treatment is very expensive, many, many times more expensive, much longer than standard TB. So we give them the medications. We also give food to the patient. A food basket is given to the patient every month and one caregiver in the family, because we found if we just give food to the patient, the whole family is starving, so they all eat it. Mm-hmm. So we give one food basket to the patient free, and we give one food basket to one caregiver. So the whole family is well nourished. And if the patient is not getting adequate nutrition, no matter how many antibiotics you throw at them, they will not improve.
Mm-hmm. Regarding Indus, if I was a parent of a patient who had clubfoot and showed up at Indus, say, before you came here and did your two-week apprenticeship here, how would that be different than, say, a year from now after you've gone back and had some time to kind of establish the program? I mean, what's going to change for the patient experience?
A huge change will be, until now, children born with clubfoot would be given appointments in a regular orthopedic clinic. And this has been seen worldwide, that if children with club feet are treated in a regular orthopedic clinic, the time which it takes for the patient to be seen, the adequacy of the casting, the time required to counsel the patient as to how to go about the treatment, the success rate is very poor. And this is what we saw. When we started early 2007, we would be doing 2 to 3 casts in a week. But now, for the last several weeks, because there's a sheer number of patients, the newborn kids just get pushed out because we've got trauma patients and patients with, you know, other problems. So these patients just get pushed away. We will be starting a dedicated clubfoot clinic, which will be on a Saturday when there is no regular consultant orthopedic clinic as such. And that will be only for children with club feet, initially newborn to 6 months of age. We will be treating older children as we go along. But hopefully within a year, these children will be treated in a clinic which is dedicated for them. The nursing staff, the staff, which is the casting technicians, will have enough training to be able to advise the family. So even if I'm not there, I can't be casting every foot. My plan is to train the trainers, and then they will be training other people, and the treatment will be going on. Mm-hmm. Even if I'm not there, the treatment will be the same as if I was doing each cast myself.
Wow, that's really amazing. So one of the other things that the American Medical Student Association thought it would be really important, you know, have bringing in foreign physicians, was to also give them a taste. You've done a really good job of giving us a taste of Pakistan, but we thought that we would want to give you a taste of Iowa. Do you want to comment on some of your experiences that you've had here outside of the hospital?
Well, everybody's been so kind. I've been taken around quite a few places, visited a lot of places which are close to, you know, within driving distance. One family, particularly the Brewer family, who work with a group called Civic, they invited me to their home to have dinner. So I went over to Asita. We had a very interesting evening discussing and trying to solve all the world's problems in our own manner. And this Sunday, they took me for a drive around the countryside, showed me as much of Iowa as can be seen by car. We stopped at a town called Muscatine, which is an industrial kind of town, looked at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum, and sort of learned about his life, which I found very interesting because Hoover was called the great humanitarian, and he was very keen and interested in helping people who were in need. His presidency was marred by the great crash of the, you know, the 1930s, and he was blamed for that and didn't win re-election. But after the end of the Second World War, he came up again as the great humanitarian, providing food to Germany, to Russia, and to hundreds of places. So I took more inspiration from his time when he was not president than from his time as a president.
So what advice would you have for AMPSA and the group who's continuing designing this project as we, you know, go forth inviting other physicians here? Has it been a worthwhile experience for you? Would you recommend it to others? And what sort of things would you like to see us improve upon?
Well, the experience has been wonderful. I think very little changes will be required because I think the whole process is so well thought out. There is no doubt that children born with clubfoot is a huge disability. And if AMSA is following this particular problem, then there's a great possibility to do a huge amount of good throughout the world. Because most of these clubfeet are in developing countries. And 90% of these children, if they remain untreated, they end up as beggars on the street. So the cost to the quality of life is immense. As part of our Pehla Kadam project, we'll be doing a costing study on this as well, the benefits provided for the earlier treatment, and that's probably the first one of its kind in the world. So everybody's quite waiting for that, but I think AMSA has chosen a very good topic, and having people from other countries come over would be a very good idea. This two-week kind of attachment, I think, is long enough to give an idea about the technique, about how it was developed, the hospital where it is being run in, mainly the University of Iowa Medical Center, because it's important to get the feel of the whole service rather than just the way to cast a patient. Mm-hmm. Because it's an integrated system between healthcare providers, not just doctors. You have to have nursing staff, you need to have casting technicians, orthotists, physiotherapists, and even counselors. I'm even listening to every word Maria, who's the, you know, the senior sort of nurse on this project, the way she talks to patients. I'm trying to pick up each word she says, how she counsels the patient as to what to do next after the cast, so I can communicate better. I think AMSA has picked a very good topic, and I would encourage you to focus on this.
All right. Well, on behalf of the AMSA Iowa chapter, I'd like to thank you so much for the time that you've spent here. Thanks for everything that you're doing, and best of luck in the future at Indus.
Okay, thank you. Thank you to AMSA. Thank you to the University of Iowa. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to The Short Coat. The Short Coat is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, you can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we're known as The Short Coat. We also take comments and story ideas and the occasional rant from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com. Or leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. That's also where you can submit a question for our advice segment, The Short Couch. The executive producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our theme music is by Revolution Void from the album Increase the Dosage. Find them at www.revolutionvoid.com.